inspiring conversations for the modern man. The Evolving Man Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Evolving Man Podcast. I'm really excited about this conversation. I'm sitting with a teacher of mine, a mentor, and a man who has written many books that I've read, and the founder of the Brotherhood group that I am a leader in, the Samurai Brotherhood. So P.T. Misselberger, as is written on your books, Phil Tirtha Misselberger, or T between friends. Thank you for coming on the show. Again, this is your second episode on the show. I think in the first episode, we talked about the dark side of the masculine. And you've just written a book called The Way of the Conscious Warrior, a handbook for 21st century men, which I have just finished reading. And yeah, thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk at length about your material.
You're welcome, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
So first, I have to say, I really enjoyed reading this book. You cover a lot of things in this book related to men, masculinity, warriors of old, legends, and you know, different warrior civilizations throughout history. And I think at least 15 Star Trek references throughout the book. Are you aware that there was
only
that many?
Only 15, I'm disappointed.
I actually really appreciated it. So, some people are not Star Trek fans and they're like, what is, I'm sure people are like, why is this guy talking about Star Trek all the time? But I grew up watching The Next Generation. And yeah, I mean, just the vision of the future and some of the concepts that they dealt with, I actually really appreciated the depth of the show. And yeah, you managed to sneak it into a book more than I think anyone has ever snuck Star Trek references into a book.
Yeah, well, it deserves it.
Yeah. So, oh man, I don't even know where to start. I mean, from the Spartans to the Knights Templar to the Mongols to Shaolin monks.
Well, let me just say a little bit about the history part. You know, it's probably more extensive than you would get in any typical self-help book. So I don't really consider this a self-help book. I consider it more of a wider examination of masculine and the masculine nature and masculine archetypes. But the idea of bringing in all the history of the warrior cultures was sort of intended as a reminder for younger men of who their ancestors are on this planet. And a lot of these times and these cultures were fairly recent. It's remarkable what we've been through. The changes that have occurred here, people from my generation, the baby boomer generation, hardly recognize the world now compared to the way it was 40 or 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. The changes have just been so widespread and so rapid and so quick. I was speaking the other day with a man who was born in 1996, and we were talking about something in the 1980s, and I said to him, you realize there were no smartphones back then? And he looked at me quizzically like, really? Like he couldn't conceive of a world without smartphones. Like, how did you... He actually asked me, so how did you find out about things?
Yeah.
You know, you had to actually knock on doors and you had to, make a phone on a cumbersome call. The first cell phone, I believe, was a Motorola in 1983, and it was something like 4 pounds.
Gigantic.
Yeah.
They're huge.
And they were $4,000.
Right.
So we live in a time of rapid change, and a lot of that change is good, and some of it is not so good. And the parts that are not so good are some of the loss of the warrior ethos and the better qualities of the warrior archetype, mm-hmm. which have to do with grit and discipline and fire and necessary battle, as opposed to, say, stupid battle or necessary battle.
Right.
What that involves, that sharpness of mind, of waking up to an embodied existence, as opposed to your most challenging battle being, playing cricket on your smartphone, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring that in as a reminder of what men historically have passed through on this, on this planet. And a lot of it was the bad old days, wasn't the good old days.
Yeah.
There's very little that's noble about warfare per se, but there is something noble about the better qualities of the warrior.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and you drop into the dark side of the masculine, the dark side of human nature, a number of times in the book. And there was a few pieces of the book that were actually quite uncomfortable to read because, like, mankind has been just awful at times. And yeah, I kind of want to steer towards this question of, you know, who is this book for? And the idea of the conscious warrior, like, I think that word is already starting to be in use. And in some ways, I feel like it is already being misused. I don't know if you know this, but there's a whole crap ton of shirts out there that say spiritual gangster on them. It's a thing now. Mm-hmm. And when I see that, I'm like, does anybody know what that means? Do the people wearing it know what it means? Or is it just like, I'm a spiritual gangster because I do yoga? Or is there something real behind that? And I think being critical of that is probably smart. And so
things are prone to fashion, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing about a fashion is that it's a passing fancy, right? And others are doing it. So let's do it also, right? It's like safety in numbers. A lot of people are doing something, so why don't we do it also? And what I mean by safety, and this does tie into masculine identity, like, what is it to discover your individuality in this world, right? A lot of spiritual consciousness is ultimately about transcendence of individuality. I write about that at the end of the book, The Way of the Conscious Warrior. Mm-hmm. The enlightenment process of the mind is going beyond the illusion of separation and individuality, but you can't get to that point if you haven't first realized your individuality. You need an ego before you can drop your ego. Mm-hmm. If you try to drop your ego before you have a clearly defined ego, you're going to be doing what we call spiritual bypassing, right? Which is a form of phony holiness. And there is strong tendency to do that in transformational work, to bypass the starker reality of what is it to know who you are as an individual man.
Yeah, I love that. Truthfully, I bookmarked, I don't know, looks like 30 or 40 pages throughout this book of 270 pages. But the only piece that I actually underlined with a pen was this one that I was reading earlier today towards the end of the book. There is no free pass to awakening. To merely know that there is no separate self or willful doer, and yet to not attempt to directly realize this, to summon no effort or burning passion passion to truly see and know this, is worse than useless, because we can run the risk of dreaming that we are awake. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that sort of speaks to the fact that a lot of people are walking around spouting Eastern, at least in Vancouver, certain Eastern wisdom teachings about, you know, well, there is no self, right? And that people sort of like use that to bypass a lot of things in their lives, not be fully present in their lives. Mm-hmm. And sort of skip what you're calling the work of realizing that wisdom.
Yeah. Well, you remember Gurdjieff, I quote Gurdjieff in the early part of this book here, to be an awakened man, you first need to be a man. Mm-hmm. It's really what this comes down to. And this is one of the functions of having a greater purpose of having a brotherhood, is the realization of what is it to be a man. And this has nothing to do with sexual orientation. It has to do with the gender that you find yourself in. And for anyone who's interested in awakening out of the illusions of this world, the constructed illusions of this world, you first need to be comfortable with who you are, or at least come to accept who you are. There's no awakening without acceptance. And so one of the greatest purposes or functions of a men's community is to help men to come to a state of acceptance of their masculinity. But in order for that to happen, they first have to encounter the parts of themselves that are rejecting themselves, right? They have to encounter their self-hatred, their self-loathing, and the way they project that outwardly by demonizing, say, their father or the man that they, their boss that they hate, or the brother that they're estranged from, or the friend that they had a falling out with, or the business associate they had a falling out with, mm-hmm. all of which tends to be a projection of their own self-loathing, right?
Yeah.
So we men, I wrote about that, we're notorious for demonizing what we don't understand.
Yeah.
It's the old Pogo quote, we've met the enemy and he is us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one particular story that you wrote in the book about an experience that you had with a karate teacher when you were younger. And I enjoyed reading about that because I've known you for a while, but I didn't know you were that good of a karate student when you were a teen.
For a while.
But I did, when you threw your first kick, I was like, that guy, that's a real kick. This guy knows, he knows how to kick. But you had this interaction with this teacher that many people, I think, would just do exactly what you're describing and just sort of demonize the teacher. He lashed out at you, and that pretty much became the end of your relationship with him, and you left the karate school. But the way that you debriefed it in the book, to me, was an example of how we need to look at what's happening in our lives and find the lessons in it rather than the objective, he was wrong, I was right kind of thing.
Well, he was, it was interesting because he was a very intense dude. I mean, he was really, a super intense guy. So when he unloaded on you, you felt it. Mm-hmm. And he did this with me in a way that was shocking and startling to my, as I describe it in the book, my 15-year-old psyche was not going to be able to integrate that experience. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was going to be out of there after that. But years later, I came to understand, what the meta message was. We always talk about, there's personal messages and meta messages. The personal message is the shit that goes down between you and another person. And the meta message is, what is the universe saying to me through this interaction? What is the pattern that's being revealed to me? So my work in subsequent years after that, when I got into depth therapy, was to really understand these patterns in my mind. And what I began to see, was just how much hatred I had for male authority. But it was there already, prior to my interaction with him. So he was symptomatic of patterns that already existed in my mind. Uh-huh. And for me to be awake, the conscious part of warrior, right, to be conscious or awake, was to be in ownership of my own patterns rather than going through life thinking that I had been, traumatized by this individual, mm-hmm. who was then responsible for this scar inside of me, et cetera, because that's not the deeper reality of what was.
Yeah, I think that's very important to point out because people have experiences like this at some point in their lives, whether they're 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 years old, and it can easily be seen as a traumatic event, and it's definitely a life-changing event. And it's often interpreted as the original event, the first event of its kind. And it's this thing that altered the course of my life. And I was never the same again. And I like how you speak to that in the book as well, around how the things that happen to you are, I don't know how to describe it. It's that, like, that situation with the karate teacher is something that actually you had patterns that preceded it,
exactly.
Right? And we need to look beyond the big thing the big thing that's in front of you. Like, you need to look behind it.
All these events are grist for the mill for a man who wants to understand himself. Gurdjieff once said, "I provide the leather, you make the shoe," meaning that life. He's speaking personally, but in a sense, life is constantly providing you with the leather for the material to either make a shoe or sit there, whining about the leather in your lap and not doing anything about it, right? Mm-hmm. But to make that shoe is to make of your life something based on all the experiences you've been through, instead of regarding them as a type of a curse, that God took a dump on me, right? I've just mm-hmm. been cursed in some way. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's like patterns, that raw material that's been given to you that you can work with if you so choose.
Yeah.
The Star Trek episode, Arena, 1967. Where Kirk is on a planet with a Gorn alien.
Yeah.
He has a fight with him, which is described on YouTube as the worst fight scene of all time.
Yeah.
Laughably bad. Worse than the Batman scene with the shark.
I've watched both, by the way.
You see the other one. But in that episode, he has to... The only way he can survive is by using the raw materials that are on this artificial planet, mm-hmm. right? And he finds all the raw materials and he makes a cannon and, shoots a diamond, which just so happens to conveniently be there, at the Gorn alien, knocks him down. And then he refuses to kill the Gorn because the higher aliens are watching to see what he's going to do with that lesson, right? Mm-hmm. But the metaphor being that the raw material of our life is always right here, right now. And that includes all the, traumatic experiences we've been through, all the breakdowns and so forth. They become the material for the breakthrough rather than being seen as a curse. But mm-hmm. It requires a certain attitude for that. And that's the important part of the conscious warrior mentality is cultivating an attitude. There's nothing more important in life than right attitude. The Buddha called it part of his Noble Eightfold Path. One of the most important eight qualities was right attitude, to cultivate that, which is the willingness to see things as a teaching in disguise. Because many times it is in disguise. It doesn't seem like a teaching. It just seems like an awful experience.
So, yeah, one thing that came up for me when you were talking about that is it can be very hard to come to these realizations on your own sitting in meditation. There is a tendency for modern men, and probably for men of all throughout history, to want to do things on their own and to want to embrace personal growth, so to speak, on their own and not in the presence of other people, and to just not really have an appetite for that kind of quote vulnerability. And just knowing your history, having worked, you've done a lot of work on yourself in meditation, but you've also done a lot of work with groups. And could you speak for a moment to that, to the idea of doing this work together and using other people to wake up?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're referring to the function of community.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about the brotherhood, the Samurai Brotherhood in particular, you know, but just from what I've seen, the power of using other people to mirror back to you what you may not be seeing or what you're showing.
Well, we have blind spots, right? It's part of the nature of the ego. So that there's elements of our ego that we just can't see, are extremely difficult to see. And for this, community has always been very important to me. You know, to quote the Buddha again, he talked about three things you need to wake up: Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, teacher, a teaching, and a fellowship. And without the fellowship or the community of you know, others that are interested in truth and waking up, it's very difficult to see the blind spots of the ego, because they don't tend to be reflected back to you. But having said that, there is a balance point that's needed between solitary experience, solitary practice. I've done extensive retreats in my life. I'm writing right now about a 40-day retreat I did in 1988, which involved 8 days of fasting and 32 days in a cabin in a Grouse Mountain.
Right.
And I had some extraordinarily powerful and important experiences with that. And this solitary work is to be balanced with community interaction. Is the best ways, right? Too much community interaction minus any solo work sets up a situation where you can become too dependent on the group. Mm-hmm. It becomes just another substitute for a parental thing or something. Too much solitary work, lacking in community. And this is a challenge nowadays, because many people find their community online, mm-hmm. right? They function, they use online interaction as their community. But the problem there is it doesn't involve bodily presence, right? Mm-hmm. So the mind gets disconnected from the body. So absence of community results in over-reliance on self, and the ego begins to, you know, develop sharp edges and becomes prickly and is not open to feedback from others, because you're just not used to it, and mm-hmm. so on. Right? Mm-hmm.
Thank you for addressing that. And for those who think that they're hearing sirens, it's sirens around us. Yeah, you're hearing sirens around us, not around you. There's a super windy day here, so I'm sure there's some trees going down or something. I want to get back to the concept of the spiritual or the conscious warrior. We talked about spiritual gangster. For a minute, if we could divide the two and look at the idea of conscious and warrior, and how I think initially this might perplex people when they look at the front of the book. So, because they seem at odds, like you have a warrior and then the idea of consciousness and you imagining like a monk or right. someone who's like fully self-realized, right. how can one be both?
Well, I mean, you know, the whole idea is, the history of warfare is interesting in that, in some ways, according to many historians, some of our best accomplishments have happened through the patterns of warfare, because in times of war, people come together, they join forces, right? And so when they joined forces, they accomplished things. Like that's what happened with the American economy through Second World War, through the Marshall Plan, when they, you know, essentially gained enormous power over, over all of Europe and arguably still have that power. It was all because of how they came together and generated a war economy during the Second World War through overcoming the Japanese and so forth. Right? So there's tremendous benefits that come together when people join forces. Then obviously there's a whole dark side of the history of war. Do you know that 92% of our history we've been involved in war?
Yeah.
So out of 3,400 years of recorded history, that approximately 3,000, I think it's 3,128 years war has been going on this planet. There's been over something 4,000 wars. So we're you know, we're predatory creatures to a large extent. We're creatures of war. We consume other forces. The universe is sort of constructed that way. So part of it is coming to terms with what we are, but how can we take that hardwiring of what we are as competitive beings that are focused on survival and make it into something more awake and more conscious, right? So in doing so, we're not throwing out the proverbial baby with the bathwater. We're maintaining some of the more useful elements of the warrior, and it mainly applies to discipline. You know, sometimes we talk about this from the Moore and Gillette book, King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, these four basic archetypes. You know, the lover is facility in a relationship, which certainly many men are lacking. The magician is the creative aspect, right? The warrior is the one with discipline. The king is the one who brings everything together. The king is all about accomplishment and completion. And so to experience one's king energy is essentially to follow things through and complete them. But you can't follow through things and complete them if you don't have the ability to be disciplined, right? That's the warrior side. So the consciousness that leads to a fulfillment and completion in life needs as one of its prime ingredients that the discipline of the warrior, the grit, the fire. You know, I talk a lot about the quality of enthusiasm. The enthusiasm comes from the Greek word enthios, which meant originally to be filled up with the divine. So an enthusiastic person was somebody who's on fire for life. The word got cheapened through the centuries to mean, you know, essentially now, if you're enthusiastic, you'd be like a fan or a sports fan or something, right? But it, originally it was a very spiritual word. It meant to wake up every morning, on fire for life, right? And to be an enthusiast in that sense. And that only comes about through seeing things through, following through on things, staying true to one's word, which is the first code of our 14-point code, right? That's why it's so important. Meaning what you say, right? Following through. That consciousness then takes all the darker elements of the warrior and transmutes it alchemically. It's like an alchemical transmutation into something higher, a higher grade of something.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking about the extremes of the warrior and the extreme of conscious, the word conscious, right? And and how that looks in a man. And I think people are more familiar with what the extreme version of the warrior looks like. I think, you know, if you imagine a Navy SEAL who is very strong, adept, disciplined, great at killing people, very structured in his life. Yeah.
Just to interject there, he may not be great at killing people. He may be rather just very, very trained in his physical discipline.
Right.
You know, a thug or an assassin may be really good at killing people. A military man ideally is somebody who's, extremely well trained physically in terms of connection between physical mind and body.
I agree. It's not just about killing people. Navy SEALs have insane amounts of training in all different fields. And I think people are more familiar with that one, but what's the extreme version of conscious, right? Is basically a guy who perhaps the outer part of his life. Well, I mean, maybe let's go back to the Navy SEAL. Perhaps he's not very emotionally intelligent, tapped into his intuition, hasn't spent much time addressing his, like, just understanding his psychology, and his inner world from that respect. He's spent most of his time creating the exterior conditions in his life where, like, he's running a tight ship externally. And I imagine a guy who's on the extreme of the, on the conscious side, mm-hmm. is, has taken all of that energy and put it sort of inwards. He's spending a lot of time in meditation. He's really into the flow arts.
Well, Bly called that the ascending man, you know, which is the you know, typically speaking, the spiritual man has been the man who can potentially be disconnected from his physical reality, mm-hmm. somewhat, right? More extreme version of that is the shaman soul, mm-hmm. who's often a bit of an eccentric and not always so grounded, let's say, right? So the vision here, what we're trying to do is bridge these two polarities, right? The, mm-hmm. you know, the very conscious, sensitive shaman type soul with the gritty, edgy, disciplined warrior. What happens when you bring those two together? You got a pretty amazing human being,
yeah.
right? They're the best of the both worlds, so to speak. But historically, they've been somewhat disconnected. I mean, there's one interesting event in history where the Tibetan, the leaders of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition back, I don't know, the 15th, 1600s, met with the great Khans of the Mongols at that time. And the Mongols were, to their credit, they were open to different spiritual teachings. And so they formed this patron overlord relationship where the Mongols agreed to protect the Tibetans militarily in exchange for teachings, spiritual teachings from right. the Tibetans. Mm-hmm. So the Tibetans became the gurus of the Mongol overlords. And they formed this really sort of unique alchemy connection.
Wow. That's amazing that the Mongols didn't just recognize the Tibetans as a weak nation and just decide to enslave them.
Well, yeah, at that point, I mean, they had done that earlier in history, but at that point they went in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point from then on, you find evidence that the Mongol military was in a state of decline, right? Because mm-hmm. they arguably their interests were changing to more of the spiritual conquest, let's say, of the uh-huh. ego, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing to say here about the warrior consciousness is that it, one of its outstanding qualities is aliveness, right? So this is one of the things that men throughout history have experienced when they've been on the battlefield or been in very, very, you know, edgy and dangerous situations in life. Even if you, you know, extreme sports would be the modern version of it, right? Some of that stuff, you know, you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. Why do guys do that? Because they're trying to satisfy their lust for life, the impulse of the lust for life that can go with the testosterone energy, which the best quality of that is a state of aliveness, right? Mm-hmm. So even monks historically, you know, say in the Zen monasteries, they had to get together and do a lot of cleaning and manual labor and gardening and so forth as a way to stay in their bodies, stay connected to their bodies. Uh-huh. Right? And, you know, again, one of the byproducts of that is a state of aliveness. So this is another really good thing about the disciplined aspect of life. When we stay disciplined, we tend to feel more alive. Right? Mm-hmm. We're accomplishing things. And combine that with the, you know, practices of meditation, which I often recommend. Code 2 in our 14-point code is work on yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Meditation practice, martial arts, psychotherapy when it's warranted, when it's required, gives you that sensitivity so that you're seeing yourself more clearly. But the grit and the discipline of the warrior gives you the aliveness.
Yeah. Yeah. So I suppose I had a question around, you know, well, you know, is that even possible? Is a conscious warrior even possible? Right. And I think I'd more rather ask, what are your favorite examples of conscious warriors, whether it be, you know, a group or individuals throughout history?
Well, I mean, some of them I talk about in the book, you know, was, you know, some of them we're familiar with more through popular entertainment, such as the ideal of the samurai, right? Why do we call our brotherhood samurai, right? It's, you know, we recognize it's a different culture. But there were some extraordinary traits of the samurai, right? The combination of the love of aesthetics, right? With the discipline, the training, the meditation, the warrior training, and so forth. The Shaolin monks, you know, another really good example that were popularized in that 1972 TV show with David Carradine. You know, was they did their research and they had they were advised by, you know, people who had actually been involved in the Shaolin Temple and so forth. And so you see that, you know, exceptional balance point between the study of philosophy and the practice of meditation and the hard physical training of the martial artist, mm-hmm. bringing those all those things together. One doesn't need to be trained in martial arts in order to experience that aliveness. But the body, especially for younger guys, should be included in some form of training. I mean, I have some friends in their 70s that are very conscious men, and they do Tai Chi or Qigong or things like this, or just simply go to the gym and have a really good exercise regimen. But this also shows up as an attitude in your life about staying sharp, staying on purpose, you know, keeping your backyard clean, so to speak. Sometimes organizing your files can make you feel alive just in the act of doing that.
Right. Yeah. Qigong is something that I have just encountered recently, and I'm very interested in going deeper into it because it's very activating. We have one guy in my men's group who's led us through 10, 20 minutes of Qigong, and I just feel so alive afterwards.
Well, a lot of the men in our brotherhood have been involved in breathing, breath work. Uh-huh. You have yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And breath work in and of itself is, you know, certainly very powerful stuff, but it is also really effective to include the body, right? And things like Qigong, they do include the body as well as the breathing, right? You see, get that synthesis together.
So, yeah, you mentioned some societies that or groups of people that were conscious warriors. Who are your favorite people? Personal examples of conscious warriors.
I'm not going to mention individuals because I feel like that'll sort of get off of the greater purpose of what I'm talking about here. And I don't think it is something to be put on individuals anyway, because no individual is a perfect exemplar of what these teachings are about. It's more useful to focus on the teachings, and I say this partly because when you examine the lives of any individual man, no matter how extraordinary he was or how powerful he was, for Gurdjieff is a good example, you'll find flaws. You'll always find flaws.
Yeah.
So I enjoy biographies. I wrote a biography of three famous gurus, you know, Osho and Gurdjieff and Aleister Crowley, very controversial men, very powerful men, very compelling lives, fascinating personalities. But, you know, as an exercise in learning and even a type of entertainment, it's fascinating to look at the lives of these individuals, but you're always going to find flaws sooner or later. So that's why it isn't necessarily the way to go. I don't really encourage people to be attached to a given personality.
Yeah. Right? I appreciated the way that you wrote the book in that way. You went into depth being 2 to 3 pages, for different warrior societies: Spartans, the Knights Templar, the Mongols, the Shaolin monks, the samurai, the ninja. And then you went into the dark side with the Nazis, certain time period in Rome, the Aztecs, the Iroquois and the Plains Indians, the Kurawai in Papua New Guinea, etc. And then it's into some specific personalities and extracted what pieces could be taken from each of these guys, right? And certain qualities that they exemplified that are admirable. And I kind of enjoyed going on that journey and looking at different characters. Some of them weren't even real people, like James Bond. You spoke about James Bond. You spoke about Bruce Lee, Steven Seagal, and Mike Tyson.
They were real. But,
they were real, right?
But Seagal plays a character that is not real, yes.
Yeah.
Repetitive guy that, you know, never loses a fight.
And so I actually really appreciated all the cultural references because
I mean, that's it right there. Let me just comment on that quickly. This is interesting. I mean, for anybody who knows about hockey, like most Canadian guys, you know about hockey. I was a rabid hockey fan for many years growing up in Montreal. And one thing about hockey is it's a sport that embraces fighting, right? It's the only big sport that if you fight with another player during an event, you don't get kicked out of the game. You just get 5 minutes in the penalty box.
Right? Other than actual fighting. Yeah.
Yeah. And the interesting thing there is that throughout the decades, I think fighting was probably bigger in hockey in the 70s and 80s and 90s. But throughout the decades, there's been this sort of mystique around the great hockey fighters. And some of them were exceptional. Like Bob Probert, for example, who was, you know, the reigning champion for like over a decade. But there was never one fighter that ever went without losing at least once.
Right.
Sooner or later, he gets his, you know, his clock rung by somebody sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And that's a good metaphor for what I'm talking about here. Why there can't be too much focus on a personality, like as a figure of hero worship or something, because eventually the personality falls. All personalities and all egos eventually fall to dust. That's the story throughout history that we know, right? And with masculine consciousness, this is a very important thing to look at, because we men can at times when we get on fire for life, our egos can get overcharged. We can experience a bit of ego inflation, right? Can become all about the immortality of the individual, leaving mm-hmm. your mark on the world, right? Mm-hmm. Who you are and so forth, right? And yet there is something innately fallible about the individual, right? So when you live your life for more universal principles, right?
Yeah.
It's about, more about the principles than it is about the individual. Mm-hmm. It's not that individuals can't be respected. And I mean, I've had teachers and mentors that I had tremendous respect for. But there's a difference between that and being fixated on an individual as representing something, mm-hmm. and then, you know, being disappointed afterwards when you find out that, you know, that the guy, eats filet o fishes or whatever. And,
yeah. You're talking about yourself now. Well,
I have the odd filet. It happens when you live on top of McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
And Prince Charles eats filet o fishes too. So I'm in good company.
Yeah, I even appreciate in the book how you address the archetype of the shaman. Maybe it's not even an archetype. I might be giving that the wrong word, but and then you mentioned these.
But it's also a real person, yeah.
Yeah, these three men from
Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and
Black Elk, right?
Black Elk,
yeah. Right. Amazing stories of these warriors who also had a shaman in them, you know, and a strong spiritual side.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Sitting Bull, in particular, you know, it's a fascinating guy to study his life, because he was, in some ways, he was the quintessential example of the warrior, had all those dimensions. He was like a statesman. Mm-hmm. He was a leader. He was a fierce warrior, especially when he was younger. He was a shaman, a mystic at the same time, right? So, I mean, he took his, when the war was lost to the Americans, he took his people and went north to Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And was Crazy Horse, for example, who was more of a pure warrior, stayed to fight, right? But Sitting Bull had that statesman quality, the mm-hmm. shaman, the king energy as well, because he knew that it wasn't about his ego being validated. It was about taking care of his people, which is always the sign of the king, right?
Yeah.
But when you read his stories about the visions that he had when he was younger, his experiences as a fighting man, he was an example of somebody who brought a lot of those elements together. Mm-hmm.
So this, I mean, in terms of who is this book for, it's for all men, you know. I felt like in many ways that you were speaking to the core of me as a man in this book. And I think this book would be a fantastic introduction for any guy who is embarking on a journey of self-discovery and wanting to dig deeper into, who am I?
I appreciate that. I also want to just make a brief comment here, Ben, about the part of the book where I talk about the dark side of the masculine psyche. You mentioned mm-hmm. there were some things that repeat in there that are very, very difficult to read, and some of the, you know, the way men have treated men throughout history. There's a reason why I did that, very specific reason why I wanted to look at that extreme darker element of the masculine nature. It's because we live in a very complex and dangerous time. We have things going on this planet right now, climate change, where the science, behind that is pretty much irrefutable. Political complexity. You look at the United States right now, if you follow politics, they're almost in a virtual civil war. I mean, they're mm-hmm. so divided amongst themselves.
Yep.
The hatred that the different political elements have for each other, the occasional radical psychopath who comes out with his gun and does something really dangerous and eliminates the lives of dozens of people just on a moment's mm-hmm. notice, which is pretty much always a man, usually a younger man, not always.
And those occasions are very frequent lately.
Right. So the purpose of me talking about these darker elements is to help men really take ownership of their own shadow, their own dark side. And ideally, we would have a world in the future where all men are in ownership of their shadow, right? Of what they're capable of doing. And so they wouldn't have to act out their shadow by demonizing forces outside of themselves. I mean, the title of the book is ironic because the goal for the future of this human race is to be free of warfare, right? Mm-hmm. So a conscious warrior in this sense is someone who consistent with Sun Tzu's teachings, the best way to win a battle is by not fighting at all. The purpose of training, say, in martial arts, is to develop that confidence where you don't have to fight, right? So what is it to feel confident about ourselves as men that we don't have to go around proving our egos to each other? Right? And historically, most warfare has ultimately been based on that. It's been based on a statement that some leader wants more territory or wants to extract vengeance for something that was done to his people in the past.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. How do we get men to a place where they're not walking around pointing the finger at the world, blaming the world for their problems?
Precisely. And, exactly. And the other element, you know, to mention just in passing is the tribal element of the fellowship, right? Because so many men who do destructive things on this planet are in a state of isolation. They don't have men they can turn to, right? And so what we've been doing with our brotherhood, and you are a huge part of that, of course, is building up that tribal community where guys actually take care of each other. They care about each other, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, imagining a world like that where men have, they have brothers in their life that they care about and they know care about them. So many issues and so many problems would be eliminated with that alone.
Yeah, it's highly underrated having a guy in your life or multiple guys in your life that are willing to say to you, hey, man, this thing, this peace that you're bringing keeps me separate from you. And this thing that I see in you here is, I see it holding you back in your life. And we need to deal with that together. Like I want to address this with you, or I don't like this thing that I'm seeing because you're either shitting on yourself or you're shitting on other people. Yeah, and what's at the core of that, man? Like, let's get to that, you know?
Well, it's the heart, you know, you're talking about the heart right there. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a good heart. I know this about you as a man. And a good heart, it can be cultivated as well. You know, you're just not just born with a good heart. You can actually cultivate a good heart. And you cultivate a good heart by recognizing the extent of your own suffering and your own pain and knowing that you've had enough of it, right? When a man has had enough of his own pain, then something can change in his life, mm-hmm. but not before that, right? If he's still having a romance with his own pain because he thinks he's unworthy and he thinks he needs to suffer more and more, or he needs to punish his father or the other tribal elders of his family system by proving that they screwed him up, by demonstrating that by screwing up in his own life and so forth, just perpetuates the cycle, right? So to cultivate the good heart is to number one, take ownership of your own pain, mm-hmm. and decide that you've had enough of that particular, you know, kind of pain. And number two, demonstrate that your life matters and that you are worthy by caring about yourself and by caring about the brothers in your life.
Mm-hmm. That there's a piece in the book where you talk about this towards the beginning, about how a man can be unconsciously sabotaging his own life as a way of punishing his father or his mother. Mm-hmm. And, I've already shared that piece publicly in a quote because it's so, it requires a double take. And I think actually a lot of people will not see that and understand that right away. It you really have to dig into the pieces around that paragraph in the book and understand what you're really saying, because a lot of people actually don't understand how the unconscious works and how powerful it is in a person's life and how we can still be controlled by our wounds in the present and be sort of just playing out a dysfunctional pattern that keeps us stuck. And
well, the main thing is, you know, men have to stop blaming their fathers for their limitations and failures in life. And I often say this, that a man becomes a man when he stops blaming his father for his life, right? And I mean, his father may have been a psychopath or depraved criminal. It's mm-hmm. not about who his father was. It's about what does he want to do with his life, right? And so when a man gets beyond blaming his history for who he is, then he's starting to take all of his natural masculine creativity and starting to channel it towards creative ends, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I often cite this image of the Sistine Chapel where Michelangelo paints God reaching over and touching Adam with his finger and sparking life into him. Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally, yes, the God of the Old Testament is a masculine God, but ideally, masculine energy at its best is a fertilizing force. It sparks things. It initiates things, right? But that energy is not available if it's consumed too much with blaming one's past for the limitations of one's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a powerful concept.
Yeah.
Really taking responsibility for your life in the present moment, really taking responsibility for your mind, and it's just ownership in general. I think people are afraid of ownership. They hesitate.
It's hard. They want to be responsible. It's a main fear of most people, both men and women, tends to be, you know, the fear of responsibility one way or another, right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't, you know, we're born into this world quite helpless. Human beings are remarkably helpless. Animals, when they're born, for the most part, they're walking within minutes or hours, right? Mm-hmm. We humans, you know, are very helpless for a long time. So we grow up with a very strong dependency on our caretakers. And so there tends to be this deep-seated resistance to responsibility. And if many people don't come into their responsibility until well into their 30s or 40s or even 50s mm-hmm. in life, which mm-hmm. is kind of a shame because it can happen sooner. But to be responsible, able to respond to different situations in your life, to navigate a life of freedom, to create in a very fulfilling, satisfying way, all of that is not possible until we make this decision to not be at the effect of our past and where we're mm-hmm. coming from, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so, yeah, my message is always that, we need more people doing their inner work, more people understanding their inner landscape, and less people blaming the world for what's going on. I mean, we're in an interesting time where things continue to change in social justice. And there's a lot of argument going on around masculine and feminine, and that being talked about synonymously with male and female. I actually ended up on a panel a couple weeks ago where people were talking about toxic masculinity, and they were using that term toxic masculinity and men synonymously, and an argument sort of ensued in the room, and it got pretty heated, and I felt lucky and privileged that the woman who was hosting the talk gave me the last word. And my message was that we're not going to get out of this mess if everybody is only pointing the finger at what they see as a problem and not doing their own work. Everybody's running around saying, these people over here, whether it's men or the masculine or abusers, are causing all of the problems in society, where like we're all walking wounded, and mm-hmm. we need to heal, right? And we need to do our own
absolutely,
work.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a place for taking action with things, for sure. Mm-hmm. So in times in life, you need to take action with things. But, personally for myself, I mean, I you and I are on the same page there. I don't subscribe to toxic masculinity. For me, there are no toxic masculine men. There are damaged men. There are wounded men, right? Same thing with women. There's no toxic femininity. There's damaged, wounded women.
Yeah.
The question is, what do you want to do with your wounds, right? And that's where the responsibility part comes in. And it's enormously powerful because political problems or social problems are just a manifestation of individuals mm-hmm. not working with their own inner woundedness, right? Mm-hmm. And so, just to really make this point clear, to be one who works on oneself does not mean you're blind to certain injustices in the world. Uh-huh. There's a place to take action and things, for sure, absolutely. That's part of the warrior, energy right there. But what is it being directed by? Is it being directed by this this desire to conquer what offends one individually, or is it coming more from a place of clarity? I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh, the famous Zen master, was asked once what he would do if a guy came into his house with a shotgun pointed at him. And what would all his Zen meditation and enlightenment do for him in a situation like that? And he responded to the question by saying that the best possible chance I would have to handle the situation the best possible way would be if I'm mindful and awake in that moment, right? So there's no magical answer to the question. Mm-hmm. The question is, are you living an impeccable life? And that impeccable is such an important word. It means, are you trying your best? Are you doing your best? There's a story about the Buddha when he was dying. He had his close students around him, and they asked him, Master, what are your last words? And he looked at them all, and he said, work out your salvation with diligence and do your best. It's basically all he said, right? Mm-hmm. In so many words, he said, do your best. give it your best shot. To be impeccable means to try your best. And the tendency to not try our best comes when we're expecting others to do it for us and resenting them for not doing it for us, right? Mm-hmm. So it all ties in.
So before we wrap up, I do want to talk just for a few minutes about this brotherhood that you founded and what's happening here. I want to ask you, what's happening here, Tirtha, with the brotherhood? You founded this men's group in your apartment about 4 years ago at this point. It started with seven or eight men.
Technically, it was founded 23 years ago, but it's gone through many iterations over the years. And you're correct. It was four and a half, close to 5 years now that we rebooted it with six men. I call it the original six, like NHL hockey, right? Six teams only.
Yeah, right.
And almost 5 years, it's gone from six to, what are we, like 250 now, 300?
I think with the Ronin guys, this is funny that we haven't tracked this exactly because we don't have a database yet, which we will soon. But
it's moving so fast.
I think we're at 300 guys because we've got four Ronin squads. So, we've got 20-something in-person squads of men, from 12 to about 17.
I think it's getting close to 30, 26 or 27.
Yeah. And four online squads,
right,
of guys at nine guys per squad. And with a high retention rate, these guys are paying members. This isn't a free membership, and a high level of commitment and no sign of slowing down. And
I know we're getting there because the other day it was a couple of captains I was thinking of, and I couldn't remember which squads they were captains of.
Yeah.
That's when I knew that I was losing track of the whole thing.
It's getting big. Yeah. And we're expanding to other cities now. And so, I guess I wanted, where do you see this going? Like, do you, it's a huge question.
Well, it's a mystery, right? One of the greatest fears human beings have is facing the unknown, going into the unknown. And something like this is very much uncharted territory. And on the other hand, it's very old. Like throughout history, the men have grouped together in organizations. 100 years ago, something like one out of every three or four men in North America was a Freemason. Mm-hmm. It was very common back then. It was the way guys, bonded. But then further back in history, guys bonded through hunting expeditions or warfare or what have you. This is the current way of bonding is more like this. Mm-hmm. I think what we have here is a really good core group of guys, exceptional also in the sense that probably 80% of our membership are millennial generation, born after certainly 1980, 1982, thereabouts, which really bodes well going forward for what can be created. But like in any organization, it faces its challenges. Guys get restless, guys, testosterone coursing through the system, you get ideas about what you can create on your own. So it's very common for guys as they develop in a system to think at some point they want to go off and create their own system. We had one guy here a few years ago that left after 6 months and started an organization called it Samurai Prime. I think he attracted three or four guys and it didn't go anywhere because he wasn't ready, right?
Right.
It's one of the...
I didn't know that.
It was pretty funny. I saw it online, but then it didn't last. But one of the codes in our 14-point code is serve a cause greater than yourself, right? Mm-hmm. To be a great leader, it's first necessary to be a great assistant. I mean, I spent years assisting, leaders and mentors as part of my own training, right? But in answer to your question, where's it going, where it can go? I don't know exactly where it's going for sure. I find that we're involved in a fascinating mystery that's unfolding step by step as things catch on. Energy goes where energy is in human dimension. In the physical world, entropy is the opposite. Energy goes where energy is not, right? So you open a room that's warm, it's cold, the heat dissipates externally. That's physical entropy. Things run down. But in human psychology, it's the opposite. Energy goes where energy is. Mm-hmm. So as we create more energy will be drawn. The question is staying true, to the principles of what this is all about, recognizing the importance of the individual as opposed to the organization, right? Organizations have needs. They have needs for structure and so forth. But this ultimately comes down to the awakening of the individual man. Mm-hmm.
Right? And much needed. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So... Yeah, I mean, we've got organizations like AA that have, they were claiming 2 million worldwide members back in 2000, you know, and it may have continued to grow since then. So, certainly it's a very inclusive brotherhood, and this type of work is very inclusive. I think it's really just about men being with men. There's, you know, no secret, process that is the one key thing that keeps the brotherhood together.
We don't have a secret handshake,
not a secret handshake, but there's just a, you know, a well-rounded foundation, you know, in the code, in your leadership, in the level of commitment that is asked of the men. And in my opinion, in having guys pay a little bit of money for their membership because there's some skin in the game and a high level of accountability. I think a lot of other groups are, the attendance doesn't have to be so strong. And through strong attendance, we end up with a bond like nothing else in this brotherhood.
Well, you take more seriously what you're invested in, as you said, skin of the game, right? So you want to be committed to something. You know, throughout history, if one attended church or, you know, any sort of was part of a religious organization, your investment or your commitment was to the doctrine, to the teachings, and you know, standing up for that, and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have a holy book per se. We don't have a holy book, you know. But what we do have is the structure that provides for men to experience the benefits that come from commitment, right? Mm-hmm. And so payment certainly is part of that, but the payment we're really talking about here is more the payment of one's energy or one's commitment. Mm-hmm. The money, a little bit of money just symbolizes that, right?
Okay, so wrapping up, so people can find your book on Amazon, The Way of the Conscious Warrior, a handbook for 21st century men.
Yeah.
And your other books via Amazon or through your website?
Amazon.
Yeah.
And if you're in Vancouver, Banyan Books carries a lot of them. Yeah. Some of my publishers are based in England, so they're carried through Waterstones bookstores in England. Occasionally they get into book chains in North America, but increasingly books more and more are available only online because the brick and mortars they don't exist so much anymore. We have Indigo Chapters here in Vancouver, but online is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. For me, this book is, it has quickly become a foundational piece that I'm going to have multiple copies on hand. I'm going to be giving to friends, new members of my men's group that I meet. Obviously, it's going to be foundational reading for guys in the Samurai Brotherhood. And I appreciate that you took the time to read it or to write it. And you can just feel that there's a level of detail in here, despite it not being as gigantically thick as some of your other books. It's impactful.
It's pretty condensed. There's quite a bit crammed in there.
Yeah, there's a lot crammed in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I encourage people to buy local or buy the book on Amazon, and leave a review, because guys like myself, have trouble leaving reviews for Tirtha because he's been on my Wi-Fi and Amazon loves to, they're going after.
Yeah, I don't mind saying this, you know, openly for the podcast. We had like five guys went to leave a review on Amazon. They were all blocked for different reasons because Amazon's become very stringent now with allowing reviews. So that's just a humorous thing. I mean, I'm not too concerned about Amazon reviews. I'm, you know, more interested in, you know, cultivating the growth of a brotherhood that helps men worldwide. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Here.
And the brotherhood, it can be found on samuraibrotherhood.com. You can surf around on the site. It's a pretty awesome site. Some good information on there in the code and in the blog. And if you're interested in joining one of the groups, we're mostly in the Vancouver area now, but I would say a year from now, we're probably going to be spread out all over North America. We've got an open house in Buffalo, New York next month.
And we've got the online groups, right?
And then we've got online groups. Yeah, there's four currently. I could see us having 10 in 2 years from now or more. We're setting up a system for that to expand. And I think if all goes well, maintaining the high quality of bonding and relationship and deep work that guys are doing currently as it grows. So thanks again, Phil, for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure, Ben. Thanks for interviewing me.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. All right, everyone. Until next time.